debt, war, corruption, treason, and an open season on human rights. Tears at the fabric of our nation, and the tragic realization is that future generations will pay the big price. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. This land is your land.
This land is my land.
If we come together and work together, we can pull the weeds that threaten to destroy our land. I hope and pray you understand we cannot reap a good harvest with a bunch of bad seeds. Wake up and shake it up, America. From north to south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Abraham Lincoln proclaimed, "We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations." He also observed, "You can fool all of the people some of the time, and some of the people all of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time."
Wake up, shake it up, America.
Our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore them. America, north and south, from east to west, from sea to shining sea, our government is a fight for we the people who can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow carefully. Wake up and shake it up, America.
Another episode of Taking Back America, the official show of Take Back America for the People, a 501c3 nonprofit whose mission is to educate the American people and people around the world about the cost of allowing corporate control of the U.S. government. On this show, like on any show in the real alternative media, we talk about things that the corporate media doesn't want you to know, and it paints a pretty ugly picture sometimes. It's can be pretty depressing. Our intent is not merely to educate you about how bad things have gotten, though. We really want to encourage people to get involved with changing things. Our guest today, Rich Borer, is one such person. He's become very involved in educating people about the realities of the history of Israel and what it means for the people of Palestine, the people of Israel, and people around the world that we allow this system of Zionism to continue unchallenged and with the support of the United States government and United States taxpayers to the tune of at least, it works out to about $1 million a day. We could probably use that money for better purposes here at home if we could encourage Israel to pursue peace with Palestine and its other neighbors, a genuine peace, not just a peace on its terms, not a peace Israelana, like peace Pax Americana, that the empire is trying to impose on the rest of the world. The point I'm getting to is there are people out there that are actually doing something. We're having some successes, so I'm going to talk to Rich about some of those today. For those of you who didn't catch him on previous shows, Rich Borer is the author of Breakthrough: Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict. I highly recommend that book, and I'm going to let Rich talk a little bit about that before we get into the main subject. Hi, Rich. Welcome back to the show, and thank you for joining us. Will, why don't you tell folks a little bit? I mentioned that Breakthrough is a wonderful history of Israel. What I didn't mention is that it's also your personal story. That's where the term breakthrough comes from, right? Can you tell people about that?
Correct. Yeah, well, what happened was that, first of all, I'm Jewish, and I was brought up in New Jersey, and I was born in 1948. So I was brought up in the aftermath of the Holocaust. And so that was obviously in everybody's consciousness, not that people were moaning about it or anything like that, but we were aware of how, you know, 10 years before, you know, I was a kid, Nazi Germany had tried to wipe out world Jewry. And I went to synagogue as a kid, and I believed all the stories about how Jews had been persecuted for thousands of years and had wandered the world, never having their own home. And then finally, Israel came into being, which was a great triumph for the Jewish people. And Israel was the one safe haven for the Jewish people where Jews could be safe, where they didn't have to worry about persecution. But the problem was that it was surrounded by a sea of enemies. The Arab world wanted Israel gone. They really wanted its destruction. And one of the main sayings that I used to hear in synagogue was that Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the most charismatic leader of the Arab world, leader of Egypt, that Nasser was, quote, the Hitler of the Middle East. Now, it wasn't until 50 years later that I learned that that was something that David Ben-Gurion had stated, and that Ben-Gurion had always refused to discuss peace with Nasser, that Nasser had made many overtures, but Ben-Gurion had ignored them. So I didn't know that until I was in my 50s. Anyway, so with this kind of thinking that was being, indoctrinated into our minds, we believed it. We assumed that God had wanted the Jewish people to end up in Israel, that this was God's blessing, that this was the Jewish people's land, and that all the Jews wanted to do was live in peace, but they couldn't because the Arab neighbors were always trying to destroy them. So that's the story. So and this is what I believe all my life. In 2006, as you may remember, in the summer of 2006, Hezbollah killed three Israeli soldiers and raided two in a cross-border raid into northern Israel. And this event, this hostility, occurred 3 weeks after Hamas had captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit on the Israel-Gaza border. And I saw this combination of events as proof that the Arab world would not rest until Israel was wiped from the face of the earth. And I was really upset about it. And I started talking to friends. And at one point I spoke to two of my wisest friends, neither of them Jewish, and thinking that I could convince them that my fears about the Arab world were justified. But when I spoke to them, and I knew that for years they had always been critical of Israel, but this time with these two events, I would figure they would see that I was correct, that it was obvious that what I had been saying, that the Arab world hated Jews and wanted to kill them, was true. And to my utter shock, they didn't agree with me, and they blamed Israel for its disproportionate use of force against the people of Lebanon. So this led me to, I went to a pro-Israel rally at the Jewish Community Center. I spoke with Jewish friends whose like-minded views on the issue relieved me of some of my anxiety, and I was just ranting and raving. And then what happened was through a series of discussions, unexpected discussions, it ended up that a friend of mine who did not resist my point of view at all, but who was Jewish and had studied the issue for many years, but was very neutral, he suggested I read a couple of books. And it suddenly occurred to me, and again, this is because if he had argued with me, I would have remained resistant. It would have reinforced my defenses and convinced me that everybody didn't understand what was going on, who I talked to. But instead, he was very neutral and accepting of what I said without arguing with me. And so he had given me the space to be able to look at what I had been doing. And I realized, you know what, I've never really studied this issue. I've never read a book on this issue. So he suggested a couple of books. So I ended up getting some books, and I started reading The History of Israel-Palestine. And one of my criteria for getting the books was that I would only read Jewish authors because I was afraid that otherwise the author would be biased. So I was reading a book, and the book was extremely well documented, meticulously documented with sources such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. And I was reading about all these horrible things that Israel was doing to the Palestinian people, such as the use of lethal force against unarmed citizens in a situation where there was absolutely no danger to Israelis, the demolition of homes, even with people still inside, the collective punishment of large numbers of Palestinians on the basis of an alleged crime by one Palestinian, and Israel was the only country in the world that tortured people, the only country in the world that legalized the torture of people and legalized political liquidation, Israel's theft of water from Palestinian villages, leaving the Palestinians with virtually no water. And at a certain point, I decided to put the book down. And when I did, I experienced, I won't go into it now, but I experienced what some people would refer to as a spiritual awakening, in which all of my false beliefs suddenly dissolved. Even my relationship to being a Jew dissolved. I realized I was as much Palestinian as Israeli or American, as much Muslim or Christian as Jew or Buddhist or Hindu. And my consciousness that had been animated by an us-against-them mentality was gone. I now realized that we were all interconnected, that the world was interconnected, and everything we do and think has some consequence in the world, and that we are all responsible. Everybody is responsible for the suffering in the world, and everybody contributes to the collective mind of mankind. And that was the beginning of my transformation. And since then, and again, that was 8.5 years ago, since then I've studied the issue pretty much daily. And so I study it through both sides. I have read books and done a lot of research for my book that you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast. I used Israeli sources, and I probably used more than 75% of my sources were pro-Israel sources, such as Israeli ministries of defense, internal security, foreign affairs. I read Alan Dershowitz, Aaron David Miller, Dennis Ross, and many other pro-Israel advocates. So that's it in a nutshell.
Well, that's a pretty powerful story. And what I took out of that that I thought was most remarkable was that what it took for the breakthrough was for you to really challenge your assumptions about your identity. You didn't mention how profoundly disturbing that was at first before you came out on the other side. But I think that's why people have such a hard time doing that, is their assumptions about their core identity, who they are, is really the problem. And so that's why I was so impressed with your book, because once you went through this transformative experience, you realized how critically important it is to help other people to question their identity as separate from the rest of humanity. That is really the ultimate problem in every conflict
right,
that is
right.
Between two groups of people who identify themselves as us versus them. That's why I thought your book was so important, and why I want you on here as often as possible. Again, folks, that book is Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict. And you can check that out on Richard Porter. Is it richardporter.com or richporter.com?
Richard.
That's what I thought. richardporter.com. All right, Rich. Well, with that, let's move on. Now, you gave a pretty good listing of most of Israel's most well-known crimes. And when I say Israel's crimes, I could say the same thing about the United States. It's committing similar crimes around the world.
Right,
but the subject
today is
Israel. So don't want people to think that you're a self-hating Jew or that I'm an anti-Semite. that's
no.
A myth they've been very good at promoting, the people who promote Zionism.
Right.
And Go ahead.
Now, what I was going to say was that those accusations about anti-Semitism and Jewish self-hatred, yes, of course there's a small number of people who are critical of Israel who are anti-Semites. And actually that number is growing, and it's growing because of the incitement by Israel, by their treatment of the Palestinians. But most people who criticize Israel they're not trying to harm Israel. They're trying to stop Israel from harming Palestinians. And asking a country to comply with international law, asking a country to treat human beings like human beings rather than like cockroaches, which is a term Israel has used for Palestinians, there's nothing anti-Semitic like that. In fact, if criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic, then that accusation is about as virulent a form of bigotry as you can have. And the reason I say that is because if it is if you are a bigot because you criticize Israel, then obviously every Palestinian must be an anti-Semite. Because what Palestinian wouldn't cry out against the theft of their homes and land, the killing of their children, the torturing of their parents? I mean, it's absurd. It's a cop-out. It's a way of shirking responsibility for your own feelings and for what Israel is doing. It's a way of remaining ignorant because people don't want to hear it. It's like you said about identity. People's identities are the lens through which they see the world, and their identities include these indoctrinated beliefs and images that they have never challenged, as you said earlier. They have never looked into these beliefs to verify them or to show that they're false. They don't want to know. And in fact, and scientific studies have shown this, the more you show someone who is firmly wedded to the Israeli point of view, the more you show them the facts and refute their beliefs, the more entrenched they will become. And that's kind of like what was happening to me until I had a conversation with that friend who was very neutral and suggested I read some books.
Well, there's a number of take-home points there. Number one is, if we are going to convince other people, we need to get past this us versus them paradigm too. We need to quit saying, these people who aren't listening are the enemy. That's not true. These people are just like you and me, and we all have resistance to questioning our identity. So we need to start with that, remembering that, and talk to people in a spirit of compassion, as you say in your book. Compassion is
yes.
The key. So you related to this individual as a person first, and that's why he was able to persuade you respectfully to check this out for yourself, and that's how you ended up challenging things. And that's what we're trying to do. And it's clearly working to some extent because we are seeing successes now all over the world in raising awareness of the reality of what Zionism is all about. You just brought up so many good things that I like to talk about. When you talk about the racism or bigotry implicit in Zionism itself, and the statement in particular that anyone who criticizes Israel is anti-Semite, I would also point out that it's bigoted towards Jews because it assumes that all Jews are pro-Israeli, and that's just as bigoted an assumption as any other generalization about every member of a group. It's just not true.
That's an excellent point. And what I want to point out, though, is that people who defend Israel and blindly support Israel and justify what Israel does, rationalize the killings of innocent civilians, including hundreds and hundreds of children, they're not really defending Israel. What they are defending are idealistic images of Israel that they superimpose or project onto the real Israel. Because if they saw what the real Israel was doing, it would be a shock to who they believe themselves to be. It would be painful. They would not be able, it would be a reflection not just of the real Israel, but of who they are. So if someone is wedded to Israeli ideology and Israeli behavior and action, constantly rationalizes it out of a need to protect their own identity, they have to continue to do that. They cannot suddenly see what is the reality of what is really happening, that Israel is deliberately provoking Palestinians as a pretext to then invade, for example, Gaza, and is deliberately targeting civilians. That's been Israeli policy for generations. They wouldn't be able to look in the mirror. They wouldn't be able to face themselves because they would see their own inhumanity. So they deny the humanity of the other, but don't know that that's what they're doing. They just convince themselves that these people are inhuman. In other words, they convince themselves that all that Israel is doing is defending itself from pathological murderers and terrorists. And that way they're protecting their own identity, but they're not really pro-Israel. In fact, what they are is pro-oppression. And what we are, we're not anti-Israel, and we're not even pro-Palestinian. We are pro-humanity. We are pro-human rights. And that's mm-hmm. really the way I like to see it, look at this situation.
Absolutely, me too. You know, what you're saying, Rich, is that in order to get people to overcome this fundamental barrier to looking at the truth about Zionism in Israel, is it's a process. It's not something that you do by approaching somebody and saying, you know what you believed all your life is nonsense and you need to reject that idea. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
It doesn't. More resistant. So if you recognize that what you're doing is a process of change, then you'll approach it a different way. And that is to introduce ideas that they cannot deny that make them uncomfortable about the other beliefs. It's called cognitive dissonance. And this is the thing people have to remember about persuading people about anything they don't want to believe. But this is one of the most challenging things that you can challenge people on. There's another thing, Rich. That is that people who are the least informed about an issue are the most resistant to change. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. And these people these people are not necessarily stupid. They simply, as you say, have blinded themselves to the truth. Once they've become, their view of things has become so divorced from reality, they cannot begin to see the reality. They only see the false image that's based on all the lies that Zionist proponents have been feeding them their whole lives, like you were exposed to as a child.
It's not just, Rick, I agree with everything you said, but I want to point out it's not just Zionist proponents. A lot of this has to do with really deep-seated religious beliefs. For example, according to the Torah, at least according to many Jews who study the Torah, God gave the land to the Jewish people. Okay, now, and I grew up believing that. Okay, now, of course, I didn't study the Torah. I was a kid. But that was the belief that was taught by our teachers and parents and rabbis and other religious leaders. And so when you believe that, and when that becomes part of your identity, it's like you said, it becomes very difficult to alter. And one thing I want to mention, though, is that there are people who are not, it's not really worth the time to approach. They're just not going to change their minds. It's the people who are on the fence, the people who are a bit doubtful about, you know, who have a certain intuition that something's wrong here, that, you know, what I've been told about Israel, just something's wrong here. This, for example, this onslaught against Gaza, why did Israel have to kill so many people and just destroy Gaza so badly? Or Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, I know elder Jews in the 80s and 90s who all their lives have supported Israel and before Israel became into being. And they are members of Jewish Federation, Hadassah, B'nai B'rith, you know, all these very so-called pro-Israel organizations. And even they, even as of a couple of years ago, were disgusted by Benjamin Netanyahu. They were able to see how Netanyahu was doing things to obstruct peace, and that bothered them. And so these are more the people that we need to approach, not the ideologues who are so committed to their false beliefs that there's nothing you can say, nothing that will persuade them. Well, maybe Jesus Christ or the Buddha could possibly do it, but I don't know anyone who has had success with people like that.
Well, and I agree, the fundamentalist religious people, absolutely. If you believe without question or not willing to question the idea that God gave land to Israel, and by the way, there's nothing wrong with believing that as long as you understand that it said nowhere in the deed that he was giving it to them in perpetuity and to all their children. It did not say that in the Old Testament and the Torah. So for Christian Zionists and for Jews, until the Holocaust, most of them understood that, that it wouldn't be right to go back and take over a land that other people inhabited, people who knew that it was inhabited. Now, of course, a lot of people lied about that, too, and said it wasn't. But I don't want to get off topic too much here. I do want to emphasize a point you made there, though, and that is that one of the excuses for Zionism is this religious belief, but it's not the only one, but it's a very important one. So you're right. You cannot challenge people who absolutely refuse to question those assumptions. You can, if you want to get into a theological discussion with somebody who's serious about it, though, convince them possibly that there are a lot of rabbis who say that, you know, the Jews were sent out into the diaspora as punishment for not following God's word. So it's fine to think he gave it to them, but it was conditional. You know, not, most people aren't going to want to get involved in these arguments, but they really happen.
Right.
And the evidence is that there are a lot of fundamentalist Christians now who are starting to speak out against Zionism. This is one of the successes that we've had. And I won't go into how Christian Zionism became so popular because, as I said, it didn't used to be. But there's something called the Scofield Bible, which was the funding
right.
of that, and the rewriting of it was by people who were trying to promote this idea of Zionism way back when. And it's become a standard teaching text for Christians in fundamental Christian churches. And again, thanks to a lot of money the Zionist foundations have put in. So we won't go into that in detail. That's something I'll talk about with Allison Weir when we get her back on here about how Zionism became so powerful in America. But, Rich, we're down to this, almost down to the second half hour, so let's talk some about the successes that we've had, because I want people to know that this movement to awaken the public around the world about the reality of Israel is really gaining momentum, and this is the time to get involved if they haven't already. So let's talk about some of the campaigns that people are working on. One of them, of course, is the BDS movement, Boycott, Divest, and Sanction, which is the same strategy they used to wake up the world to the evils of apartheid in South Africa. Do you see parallels between the BDS movement for South Africa and the BDS movement for Israel?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's a growing movement. It has basically the same goals, which is to end apartheid or end racism and human rights abuses and to establish freedom for the people who are being targeted by the oppressors. Yes. You know, of course, it's the difference is that, and hopefully this difference will vanish, but the difference is that it wasn't until the United States finally joined the movement against South African apartheid that the South African apartheid system and government fell. I don't know if the United States, it doesn't look to me like the United States is very close to really taking Israel to task. I mean, obviously the latest rift between Netanyahu, the racist segregationist, and America's African-American president is, in my opinion, at least a bit of a breakthrough. But the United States has always been, and really still is, Israel's best friend, you know, and a blind supporter and a facilitator and enabler of Israel's human rights abuses, which, of course, is against American law, not to mention international law. So that's the key. The key is that the United States has to, at some point, tell Israel, you cannot do this anymore, and we're not going to support it. Because Israel cannot maintain the occupation without the money it gets from the United States. More than half of Israel's military budget comes from the United States. So they just wouldn't be able to do it. But I don't know how long in coming that is going to be. When you see Congress voting almost 100% to support Israel and to say that it's okay what Israel did in Gaza or Israel's, you know, assaults, again, you know, that Israel's only defending itself. I mean, these resolutions show just how utterly, utterly ignorant and frightened our Congress people are and how badly they put their desire to be reelected and their desire to collect campaign donations, how badly they put that above the rights of human beings who are being killed, tortured, and denied a future.
That's true. I think you said it well. It's both ignorance and it's venality. I'm shocked by how some decent people in Congress have no conception of what's really going on the international scene, nor do they feel they have the responsibility to learn. They just buy what they're told.
They never do their independent research. In a way, our Congress people are frauds. They are putting on the face to their constituency that they are well-versed in the subjects on which they vote, that they study the issues, that they are knowledgeable, and that they know more than most Americans. And the truth is, all that they know is either what they're told by the lobby group that gives them the money, for example, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the large Jewish arm of Israel that is a lobby organization. They write bills, they pass out information to the congresspeople, and congresspeople know that if they don't vote the AIPAC way, they're being watched by AIPAC. And if AIPAC decides that they're not pro-Israel enough, AIPAC will fund their opponent in the next election. And this is why 75% of Congress attends AIPAC's annual convention in Washington, D.C. every single year and panders to these Likudniks, these people who are basically Benjamin Netanyahu clones. And it is really a disgrace that these people are so greedy and so frightened that it's much more important for them that they get reelected than that they stop the horrible killing and human rights abuses that goes on every day in the West Bank and Gaza.
Well, you made some great points. Again, AIPAC, if you look at who AIPAC is, they are right-wingers. You call them Likudniks. And that is, that's the right-wing, even in Israel, let alone right-wing opinion in the United States about Israel, which is not the same thing. They represent a small proportion of well-funded and well-organized right-wingers who are pushing so-called liberals to blindly follow the Netanyahu line. And I'll give a couple examples. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren voted for those resolutions you talked about, to just, completely one-sided resolutions to say how wonderful Israel is, how there's not a hair's breadth between U.S. and Israeli interests, and how they support them completely, and Hamas is guilty of every war crime that occurred in the last conflict was because of Hamas. They've actually passed resolutions like that, and so-called liberals supported those. Now, but I promised I was going to get to the positive part. Representative Boehner, Speaker Boehner, invited Netanyahu to speak, and Bernie Sanders, who's got a lot of criticism for never, ever standing up against Israel, he actually said he won't attend, along with 26 other Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate. And there's a big campaign on right now to try to get people to let their members of Congress know that you expect them to boycott it. This is a wonderful opportunity to show that the American people do not support Israel blindly, even if their so-called representatives do. Now, Rich, I don't know, have you ever seen any statistics about how many American opinions, I should say, on Israel?
63% of Americans oppose Netanyahu's visit and forthcoming speech before Congress. And I think if you just hook the people who are registered Democrats, that figure goes over 80%.
Mm-hmm.
But, Netanyahu is identifying with the Republican Party. But Rick, I want to correct one thing you said. Yes, AIPAC can be called Likudniks. However, even the Labor Party, which is supposedly much more liberal than Likud, and they are in many ways, but even they have never really wanted to make a fair peace. And in fact, more settlements and a greater number of settlers have gone into the West Bank, have settled in the West Bank under Labor Party governments than under the Likud party governments. And, there's a myth that Ehud Barak, when he was prime minister in the late 90s up to 2001, there's a myth that he offered the Palestinians a very generous deal, peace agreement, and the Palestinians rejected that. Well, that is nothing more than a myth. He basically came to Camp David in 2000 with the intention, after he was already not even complying with the Oslo Accords, he suddenly wanted to come to Camp David. There was no real foundation for this visit. The Palestinians knew it was ridiculous, but they had to go because otherwise they'd be painted as obstructionist to peace. And Israel did not offer the Palestinians, did not show a single map to the Palestinians. They made no real offer. Barak would not meet with Arafat or any other Palestinian the whole time he was there, except once he met with Arafat for tea on the condition that nothing of substance be discussed. And when it was over, Dennis Ross and Bill Clinton, who had promised Arafat they wouldn't put the blame on him, immediately put the blame on him. And the fact was that what was discussed was, as Shlomo Ben Ami said, and Shlomo Ben Ami was the head of the Israeli delegation, what was discussed at Camp David, what Israel sort of offered, was, as Shlomo Ben Ami said, far short of even modest Palestinian expectations, and that Shlomo Ben Ami would not have accepted such a deal either. And so, you know, we have to rid people of these ridiculous myths that are constantly being put out by the Israeli propaganda machine, also known as the Government of Israel and AIPAC.
Yep. I agree. Although I will stand by the statement that AIPAC is Likudniks. They are to the far right.
They are. You're right. They are.
But I want to. Okay. I promised people I was going to stick to the positive here. So let me make a couple points here. You mentioned earlier that, you know, the big problem here is that the government, and this is what we've been talking about for 5 minutes or so, that the U.S. government, our so-called representatives in the White House and Congress, don't really have the courage to speak up. Well, the truth is, if enough of us speak up, they won't have a choice. Because no matter how much money they get, if nobody's going to vote for them because of this issue, then they aren't going to stand for Israel. And that's what happened in South Africa. And in particular, when the students got involved and really spoke out and let people know the truth and pricked their consciences, then eventually there was such an overwhelming tide of support to end apartheid in South Africa that Reagan didn't have a choice. He didn't want to end apartheid. People in power in the United States, regardless of their party, they like to go along with this status quo because that's how they got in power, right? So it's up to the people to challenge that and say, no way. And we're seeing evidence that that's happening. Let me give you one piece of evidence. You may be familiar with this, maybe just didn't think about it when I asked you about American public opinion. Pew Research does polls, I think, every year on American Jewish opinion on Israel and the government of Israel. There's a definite trend that Jews, especially younger Jews, are not identifying as strongly with Israel, more opposed to this increasingly right-wing government that they've had for years now, but especially since Operation Cast Lead. So there's a very important piece of progress. And I mentioned earlier that Christian Zionists are all fundamentalists. Christian Zionists are also there's a shift in their opinions. We're seeing polls showing that. I don't know about the general American public, but those are two of their strongest supporters, and they're changing. So people need to realize this. If you're afraid to speak up because some loudmouth racist is going to try to shout you down, don't be afraid, because you are the ones in the majority. I'm convinced, based on studies like that you are in the majority. And when I was I attended a rally, anti-AIPAC rally in Portland a couple of years ago. I was surrounded by people not just wearing kafirs, the traditional Palestinian scarves, but there were a lot of Jews there too, and they were standing side by side with us, demanding justice and demanding that the truth be told. And they were standing there when my senators, Senator Wyden and Senator Merkley, showed up as honored guests there. By the way, that was the year, Rich, I was running for the Senate against Senator Wyden, and I had a ticket. And AIPAC contacted me and said, "Oh, by the way, you're disinvited." They did a background check on me, and I wasn't even that active at the time. It's amazing the extent to which they dig in to try to control the message. I was nobody. Nobody had heard of me. I mean, hardly anybody knew I was running for the Senate because I didn't get any attention by the corporate media. That's how bad this problem is of controlling the message. But in reality, I think we're in the majority already.
I think you're right, but it's a silent majority. A lot of people are afraid to speak out, and the most, it's usually the fanatics on either side who end up, controlling the argument, because their fanaticism, their loud mouths end up alienating people who are more in the middle. So then as people in the middle say, hey, I don't want to deal with this, this is too crazy, the concentration of these fanatics grows on either side. Now, and there are fanatics who are, as we've said earlier, are anti-Semitic, and that is very harmful to the cause because there are a lot of people, I see it all the time, I've met some of these people, who basically sound like they could be Nazis. Their rhetoric is all based on how Jews are all liars, Jews control the media, Jews control banks, Jews control the country, Jews control our minds, and they're constantly making statements that tell supporters of Israel, yeah, we need Israel. We need Israel to defend itself because these people will destroy us. They're actually a great impediment to the movement. And so the whole, what has to happen is there has to be a real change of consciousness, not just, although mostly, but not just on the so-called pro-Israel side, but even on the side that fights for that claims to fight for Palestinian rights. Because if you have people who still believe in an us-against-them world, who look at Jews and Israelis the same way that the Benjamin Netanyahu, for example, looks at Palestinians, you're going to have the same kind of problem in ad infinitum, because even if Palestinians gain their rights somehow, it will still be an us-against-them world. It will still be a world filled with enemy images and people trying to do to the other what they think the other is trying to do to them. And so
exactly.
This change of conscience is really important. And it's why people have to pay attention and learn to think for themselves and do their own research. And it's why our education systems have to start encouraging and even having courses on critical thinking and on challenging the most basic beliefs they have to find out if they really are authentic or if they are simply ideas that have been come through us over generations as a way to control who we think we are.
Absolutely. What you're talking about is two groups of people who are diametrically opposed to each other in those basic assumptions about who they are. And these are the ones also I would point out. You talk about how these ideas are driven into us as children through education. They're also driven into us by the corporate media. We hear about
right.
the extremists. It isn't that they're in the majority. That's who we hear about, though. And so people get this
right.
false image that these are the only people who understand the issue, and they completely disagree. So, how can I figure it out? I don't know what the truth is. They don't do
yeah.
the research.
But, you know,
this is what
let's just take one example.
Okay.
Sheldon Adelson, the big casino magnate who is very close friends with Netanyahu, he's an extreme right-wing Republican Jew. He wants to nuke Iran. He just recently had a gathering in Las Vegas where all the potential Republican presidential candidates had to go to basically worship at the feet of Sheldon Adelson. And, of course, they didn't have to go. They could have said, no, I'm not going. But if they wanted his money, like he gave tens of millions of dollars at the last election, if they wanted his money, they had to go, and they had to prove to him their fealty to Israel. And he one thing about Adelson is, for some reason on the right, there's far more money being spent by these billionaires to support right-wing ideology than there is on the left. And Adelson started a newspaper in Israel. It has the largest circulation by far in Israel. It's a newspaper that promotes Benjamin Netanyahu, and it is free. And so a lot of people read it. And his whole purpose is to control people's minds and convince them that Israel is innocent and what they're doing is to the Palestinians is justified, and that the Palestinians are nothing but a bunch of terrorists. This is the kind of indoctrination that is being perpetrated by these people who control, to a very large extent, government media and education systems. And so that's why people have to learn to think for themselves, because right now, even though the movement is growing, and a lot of it has to do with the actions of Israel that are so blatantly inhumane. So Netanyahu has actually facilitated the movement for Palestinian rights, because he's shown such a greedy, violent face to the world that people are waking up. But there has to be critical thinking, and people have to learn how to challenge the beliefs that are circulating in the world so that they can find out for themselves what is false and what is true.
Absolutely, and that's what we talked about earlier, is how to get people to do that. And again, I want to recommend Rich's book, Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, A New Perspective on the Israel-Palestine Conflict, because it really goes into what needs to happen in the minds of these individuals for them to see the truth. Rich, I said I was going to focus on the positive here, and I want to emphasize a point you made there. You said, despite the fact that Netanyahu and the Likudniks and the Knesset in general is getting more and more vicious towards the Palestinians, the fact is that that's waking people up. And I would also argue Adelson's actions are aiding the anti-Zionism movement or the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, whatever you want to call it, because people are so disgusted when they see this. This is actually making it in the corporate media. They aren't doing this in secret. He isn't forcing all these Republican candidates to show up in secret to bow before him and swear fealty to Netanyahu. He is doing this in public. And he's doing that because he wants to frighten anyone from saying no, because it isn't just a matter of not taking his money. It's a matter of saying, I don't represent Israel. Or at least that's what it'll say in the minds of people. And so the good part is people are understanding this. And when Adelson pulled this crap when Netanyahu was invited to speak in 2012 during the presidential election here, a lot of Jewish Democratic leaders were very angry that he was trying to influence the election. And people saw for the first time, wait a minute, the Israeli government is not all Israelis, and it's not all Jews for sure, because most American Jews are liberal, which means they do prioritize human rights. And so when they're criticizing the government, that people stand up and take notice. And the same thing's happening with this Adelson situation. Israel's interests are not identical to our own. Those were two really big stories in the media that helped wake people up to the fact, hey, you know, gee whiz, our interests are not exactly identical. At least Israel's interests, as defined by these right-wing wackos like Adelson, is not, and Netanyahu, that's not the same as American interests. So anyway, Rich, we've gotten into some great detail here, and I want to just list some of the other positive things, and we'll go into as much as we can, because we've gone into so much detail on some of these other things. I don't want to miss the point. All these positive things going on. Let me just mention some, and then you and I will discuss whichever ones we have time for. So we started out talking about BDS. Well, SodaStream was a big campaign of Code Pink and other groups. They were manufacturing this product in the illegally occupied settlements. They were shut down. Well, they got so much bad publicity, they were forced to move out of there into Israel proper.
Have they actually finally moved? I know they announced they were going to move, but I don't know if they did.
Okay, they announced it, but that's a victory in itself. The boycott movement is working, and divestiture move. There's been academic boycotts by a number of international academic institutions. They will not appear in a lot of them won't appear in the occupied territories, but more and more of them won't appear in Israel either. Stephen Hawking very famously spoke out against Israeli apartheid and really the whole Zionist system. So that's a major one. Divestiture. Again, student involvement is so critical. That's what really got us going in ending apartheid in South Africa. There have been numerous universities that have divested themselves of any company that does business in Israel, and so have a lot of major churches on the national level. What else? Student groups are fighting back for their rights to speak out against Israel on the campus. They've been systematically discriminated against. Some of the Jewish groups like Hillel have been systematically infiltrated by AIPAC and their funded supporters.
Rick, the thing about Hillel, it's not that they've been infiltrated by AIPAC. Hillel has always been a reflection of the Israeli government, and recently a number of more reasonable Jewish kids on college campuses have kind of come out and said, we we're Jewish, we're entitled to be members of Hillel. It shouldn't just be confined to Jews who support Israeli oppression. And this has created a national argument, and they have gained some inroads into Hillel. Okay?
Right. So I apologize.
It's not, I mean, AIPAC is not like this godlike organization that controls the debate. They're very influential. But, like, for example, Rick, I had never even heard of AIPAC until 2006.
You know? Really?
So I had never heard of them.
Well, yeah, I sort of used them as a proxy for all of the Zionist organizations that really do provide funding to literally, you know, to influencing the media, to influencing grassroots groups.
Yes.
And so it's a proxy. And maybe this was natural that Hillel was more pro-Israel for all the reasons you said earlier. But the important point is that that's starting to change.
And there is real
debate going on in campuses, and that's going to help the divestment movement. So let me just run through a couple more things, and then we'll get back to – you can make more comments on this stuff. A number of countries in Western Europe, starting less than 6 months ago with Sweden, a number of countries in Western Europe have now joined countries in Latin America and elsewhere around the world in calling – or in saying they will recognize a Palestinian state as soon as one is established. So they're sort of putting pressure on that way to do that. And the UN did recognize a limited status for Palestine, which gave them the right to join a lot of international organizations. These are all major victories, in part just because
they made
the news. You know, they normally don't see any victories in the news on this topic, because that's one of the ways they control the debate. They don't want you to know that this momentum is growing. They always present it as if Israel's interests are identical to the United States. Everybody accepts that. So even when they report on these victories, it's like, oh, gee, look at these nuts. Look at these nutty, wild-eyed liberals in Europe saying this stuff. Well, the fact of the matter is, I'm sure it's waking up a lot of Americans. And that's so we started seeing these changes before any of these victories. We started seeing changes in the numbers of people who don't support Israel or the Israeli government. Now with this, I think that's going to accelerate. Oh, one more thing, Rich, before you comment. There's a Israeli-controlled shipping company. When I say Israeli, I mean the state of Israel has controlling interest in Zim, which is a multi-billion-dollar per year industry. It's a huge contributor to the Israeli economy. Well, there's been a movement to keep them from landing in any American ports. They've been stopped from landing several times, each time costing them tens of millions of dollars. That's how much value there is in these shipping contracts. They were talking about ending their contract with the Port of Los Angeles because of this is going to be a recurrent problem. There's such a huge movement to stop them between union workers, between Palestinian solidarity groups, between a whole variety of human rights groups. All these people see that it's in their interest to stand against this kind of injustice, and they insist they're going to blockade it forever. So they talked about actually, and I don't, maybe they have, ended the contract so they can't land in L.A. anymore. There have been similar protests in Seattle, in San Diego, and in other places too. This is amazing campaign that's not getting any publicity in the corporate media. Any comments on that?
No. I remember when it was in the news, or at least in the alternative media, and I was very happy to see that. I agree. All segments of society, from blue collar, white collar, all segments of society need to get involved in this issue, because it does. It's not just an issue that involves Israelis and or Jews and Palestinians. It involves really the whole world. It's the linchpin of what is going on in the Middle East. Israeli analysts have even said that. Ami Ayalon, who was the head of the Israeli Navy before he was the head of Shin Bet, has said many times that if you want peace with Iran, then you have to make peace with the Palestinians, that is the key. And so people have to realize that the United States giving all this attention, all this support for Israeli human rights abuses and violations of international law has a major effect on the world. It affects the way the Arab world views the United States and the West. Because when they see that a country that touts itself as the world's greatest bastion of freedom and democracy, the first great democratic nation in the history of humanity, when they see that this country supports some of the most horrible human rights abuses and anti-democratic policies, it creates an awful lot of anger in the Arab world and contributes to the growth of movements like ISIS. I'm not saying it's the only reason, but it certainly has a lot to do with it. So that's something that people have to bear in mind.
Well, absolutely. And, in a more global frame for understanding what's going on in the Mideast, and in Ukraine and other places in the world, is the U.S. military is now 60% roughly of our discretionary budget. So does this affect Americans directly? Absolutely.
Right.
Because if it weren't for the fact that we're this tightly connected to Israel, we wouldn't have to be spending all this money to fight wars and proxy wars throughout the Mideast and around the world. But unfortunately, because our foreign policy establishment has been taken over by these right-wingers who do think that Israel's interests are the same as America's. The oil companies profit very much from those. The armaments companies profit from these wars. And so it all fits together very nicely, and nobody wants to mess with that either. That's actually a huge part of the reason of what we're up against. But again, if people realize that all these things are connected, it's in all of our interest to ensure justice in Palestine. And by the way, in doing that, we also establish justice in Israel, because Israel cannot be a democracy as long as it's apartheid. Those two things are mutually exclusive. Democracy is based on equality. Apartheid is exactly the opposite. So, Rich, we've just got like a minute left. You want to sum up any thoughts you have about everything we've been discussing?
Right. Well, what I'd like to really say, and this is really more this is to everybody, but more to the people who support Palestinian rights, is that a principal reason it has been so difficult to solve this Israel-Palestine problem is that at a fundamental level, we are really not dealing with a political problem, and nor are we dealing with a territorial, a religious, a cultural, or humanitarian problem. We are really dealing, and people, I hope people can get this, we are really dealing with a spiritual problem, which is a problem of identity and of the mind. And like I could never have understood the problem until I understood my own mind and my presumed, you know, limited and mortal identity. And in my research, that's what I ran up against. I ran up against my identity, which was my indoctrination into a lifetime of propaganda about me and my so-called people, the Jewish people. And this confrontation that I ran up against, well, at first it produced some shock, but the painful feelings I discovered in myself were a wound, but they were a wound that was necessary because they were the doorway to the end of existential fear and confusion. And so one's presumed identity, and it's only a presumption, it's an indoctrinated presumption.
That identity is the root of fear and confusion. Yes, I got to cut you off there. We're out of time. I just want to say, though, in your book you mentioned that really freed you, and I think people will find that's true of them, too, if they read that book. So check it out.
It's a great relief.
Yeah, richardforer.com. Thank you, Rich, for being on the show again.
Thanks,
we'll have
Rick.
You back. That's it for Taking Back America this week. Join us next week.